Phil Lesh at the Grateful Dead, and you're listening to WBAI FM New York City 99.5.
And yes, it is WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock, 1 hour before Off the Hook usually comes on the air. This week, Expert Witness will not be on. However, Expert Witness will be on for 5 hours next week. So you have all the expert witnesses you can possibly imagine next week at the same time. Now, stay tuned for Off the Hook. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you for an extra hour this week as we're doing fundraising for this great place known as WBAI, the radio station that brings you programs like Off the Hook and so much more. We'll be going into great detail as to why you should be supporting this radio station if you don't already know it. And giving out the phone number, 212-209-2950 is the number to call. Did we really get that amount of money in the first minute of the show? I don't think so. I think that's probably left over from the last show. So that's the number to call to pledge, but stay tuned for the next 2 hours. We're going to have all kinds of interesting announcements and facts, and we'll even have some listener phone calls and all kinds of things like that. Isaac, how are you?
I'm fine. So are yourself?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. It's been a hectic week.
It has indeed.
It really has. This CD that I'm playing, in fact.
You always have the most interesting music.
I do, don't I?
This is how I happen to educate myself in the modern music.
People send music to us. And this is to be encouraged, because when people send music to us, we play it. We listen to it. Unlike those other radio stations that...
They just kind of get shelved.
Yeah, they get thrown out. Not shelved.
Thrown out.
You're lucky if it gets shelved. Go ahead. Turn around on the FM dial. Wander around all over the place. You won't hear music like this anywhere. Of course, we're on the commercial part of the dial, which is the incredible part.
Smack dab in the middle.
But like I was saying, this CD, which someone was nice enough to send us, this is Wall of Sound, may have cost me a great deal. Because I was previewing it in my new Macintosh Cube. You know, those are cute little computers.
Oh, so you like slip it down into the...
Well, yeah, you put the disc in, it kind of sucks it in, and it starts playing it. And, you know, I thought that was really nifty, and it was playing. I mean, I've been doing this for a while. I've been doing a lot of things with the Mac Cube. I've been archiving my entire CD collection into MP3s. We'll get into that later when we go into the whole Napster discussion. And unfortunately, when I was listening to this, I said, yeah, you know, this sounds good. I think maybe we'll play some of this tonight on the radio. And I asked it to eject the CD.
Uh-oh.
It refused. Apparently, it liked this song so much, it just kept playing it. And I had to go, you know. I had to start the drive into the city. And it wouldn't eject the disc. And I couldn't find any little hole to, like, you know, stick a pin in so that the thing would eject manually.
You just tucked the whole machine under your arm, didn't you?
No. Well, you know, in retrospect, I should have done that. No, what I did was I pushed the button. There's a little white flashing light that the little cube has. When it goes to sleep, you see this little light flashing.
Right.
And for those people who don't know, this Macintosh cube, it's a, you know, you could literally carry it under your arm. It's a little tiny. It's as big as a bread box.
It's 8-inch cube.
Yeah, that's really what it is. So I pushed the button. And the power went out to the screen and all that. Apparently, it was hung. It was hung on this song, but it was still playing. The music was still playing while this was going on. So the screen went off, and then I pushed the button again to reboot, and the screen came back on exactly where it left off. So I didn't do anything by turning it off. I tried this a couple of times. It just would not release. It would not release the screen. It would not release the CD. This thing was stuck. It was holding on to it. I couldn't get my CD out. I couldn't get my Mac to even reboot. So, I unplugged it.
You deprived it of power.
I had to. I had to. It was just, it was annoying me, so I unplugged it, and the little white light went out.
No.
Yeah. And when that happened, when the little white light went out, I kind of felt maybe that I shouldn't have done that. Maybe that was wrong.
Yeah, it's not nice.
So, anyway, I plug it in, and the thing really did reboot this time, except it got to the point where, you know, you get to the finder, and I got this error that said something like, what was it, Q-Watcher. Yeah, Q-U-E-U-E. Q-Watcher, address, wrong address or something like that. It gave me this little bomb on the screen, and I can't boot anymore. I was able to eject the thing because I pushed the eject button quickly before the error came up, but now it just won't boot anymore. So this CD, which somebody sent me, may have cost me my computer. Yeah. You think it's funny, huh? It's hilarious.
I don't think it's that serious.
My cube is dead because somebody sent me music.
Well, no. Anyway. I don't think it's the person who sent you music. I think it's the fact that you deprived of power for
it. Was it's a CD virus is what it was.
Oh, come on.
It was.
No.
Malicious code.
I think it's
injected into my Macintosh.
I think it's just being unhappy because you pulled the plug.
Well, you know
he's
what?
I'm not happy with you.
I'm going to listen to the song again because... if it's going to cost me that much, I might as well listen to it a whole lot of times.
Are you encouraging other people to send you CDs that will break your computer?
Well, no. Send us CDs that don't do things like that. Send us CDs that aren't so good that the Macintosh won't release you. And if anybody knows what a Q-Watcher error is, please let me know. I haven't booted with no extensions yet. I'm going to try that later. But nope. I had to get out. You know, this was with me being late for the show because I had to drive in an hour earlier this week. It was really, horrible. So anyway, we have an extended show tonight. Hopefully, there won't be any more glitches like that. We do have a great potential for a glitch because we have some excerpts from the H2K conference we're going to be playing tonight. We have a very special deal for people who are calling in and pledging. You know, that number is still on the screen. We did not raise any money yet. So,
well, what number do they have to call?
Well, I'm about to get to that. I'm saying to the Tally people, we need to start fresh, and the number to call is 212-209-2950. We have a whole lot of dedicated Tally people down there who are volunteering to come in, answer the phones, and take your pledge. And we have all kinds of interesting things to entice you, as well as just the general feeling that this is the right thing to do. And if you have doubts, and I understand people have doubts about that for all different reasons, we'll be very happy to explore that and to come to an answer together. All right, in a moment, we're going to play something from the H2K conference. Stay tuned. Okay, I think we've got our act together here, Isaac. We're going to panic at the last minute here.
I'm just going to make sure.
All right, what we're actually doing here is we're playing part of a mini disc of, and you know we're going to get this wrong somehow because we always do. But let me give some background while we attempt to plug things in and make sure they work properly. The H2K conference took place last summer here in New York City. It was a gathering, the third gathering of computer hackers from all over the world. And I think this one in particular had the most as far as content. We had diversity all over the place. And what we're going to hear first, we're going to hear two different pieces from that. The first thing we're going to listen to is something from someone I've known for quite some time, a private investigator who goes around investigating people, investigating all kinds of things. It's amazing what you can find out about people if you just know what you're doing. This guy's name is Steve Rambam.
Yeah, I met him at Beyond Hope.
Yeah. Well, you might have also met him at H2K because he was at Beyond Hope in 1997. And
well, I met him once. That was I simply continued our relationship at that point.
Uh-huh. Well, you didn't continue it very fruitfully because you missed him at H2K.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and he did a rousing talk there. He did a rousing talk at Beyond Hope. What we're going to try to do now is play you excerpts from the first. I see people looking worried and puzzled. Is this going to work?
I'm pretty sure.
All right. So
if it doesn't, you flip that switch back.
Well, that switch, if you recall, if I flip it like this,
yeah.
And then I bring this up, doesn't make any noise at all. Okay. I guess it's all right. It's cassette one, right?
Yeah, cast one.
Okay. Let's give it a whirl, see if it works. Hopefully, next thing you'll hear will be the sound from the H2K panel, and we're going to come on right afterwards and tell you how you can get this plus every other videotape. It's actually a videotape. You know, you can't see the video on the radio, but we're going to come back and tell you how you can obtain that and all the other videos at H2K.
You know what? Let's start and pray for a live connection in the next 10 minutes. My name is Steve Rambam. I'm an investigator. Many of the people in this room know me, have worked with me for the past 15 or 20 years. For the one fella who thought he won the Spot the Fed contest, where is he? Guess again. Hackers and private investigators have an enormous amount in common. The most important thing in common is that we all not just believe, but know how important open information is to create a level playing field. Today, the most important grantor and guarantor of power is information. If information is closed, the few people that have access to it will have nearly unlimited power from its use. If we get a live connection, I'm going to demonstrate to you some private databases out there that, frankly, allow everyone to work as their own private investigator, allow moms to collect from deadbeat dads, background investigations, what have you, without having to rely on law enforcement or, even worse, the government. There is now a movement by so-called privacy advocates to close all information in the U.S., everything from driving records to vehicle records to property records to corporation ownership to permissible portions of your credit report, typically called credit headers. And the privacy advocates, because their argument sounds great, have been almost universally successful. You cannot access driving records anymore unless you go through a private investigator or you have a subpoena. An act was passed called the Driver Privacy Protection Act. You cannot, in the state of California, for example, access voter registration records. Real property records are in the process of being closed in Washington, D.C., which I guess is at the behest of all of the elected individuals that own property. After November 12th, every portion of credit records will be closed. You will need the same justification, Fair Credit Act justification, to obtain even a Social Security number verification that you now need to obtain a full credit report. The end result of this is going to be that the average person, 99.9% of the people in this country, will have no legal access to fairly essential data sources and information. Information which allows them to check the background of a nanny, collect the debt, verify that the person driving their school bus doesn't have a DUI conviction. Let me give you an example of some people who slipped through the cracks. I just did a case in Washington where the administrative director of a law firm, when we redid his background investigation because he had just passed the bar and he wanted to become an attorney for the firm, we found out that the Bar Association had missed two prior convictions in Iowa, that he was a two-time loser. I'll give you the headlines from some newspaper articles. A former Orthodox priest was accused of stealing nearly $200,000 from his former employer. A former Green Run High School security officer was convicted of four misdemeanor charges. Teacher facing abuse charges can't tutor kids. Monroe City Nursing Home administrator sentenced to life in prison without parole for a stabbing death. All of these people had prior arrests that would have shown up had their employer or the people responsible for screening them prior to hiring them had they been able to check background. While data is being closed, bizarrely, there is now more data available than ever, which ideally would be available to the masses. I know that double click and cookies and various other types of data gathering methods have been in the press lately, but the fact is there are much better methods of gathering information that are being used today that provide a complete dossier on almost everyone in this room without their knowledge. Every computer today has a GUID, a universal identifier, which tracks that user's every step on the internet. It doesn't matter if they delete cookies after every session, that GUID is still reachable. If you've bought a Pentium 3 and you haven't actually taken the steps to turn off the Pentium chip's serial number, that tracks you. If you have a high-speed connection, especially DSL, ISDN, in your home, everywhere you go, your unique IP address tracks everything you've done. You can delete cookies, you can avoid double click, you can turn banners off, it won't help. In addition to that, for the past 20 years, every major marketing company in America has been developing and perfecting something called psychographics. I'm sure you've all heard of demographics. Demographics is ancient history. Psychographics is the way to go. For example, a $1 million study discovered that people who own cats and drive Volkswagens like Skippy peanut butter. It's an actual study. The vast majority of the people who own cats and drive Volkswagens, like Skippy peanut butter. Skippy peanut butter has marketed the hell out of those people. It is an innocent marketing study, but it's an example of what's possible. Mailing lists. If you are a member of the NRA, you probably own a gun. It's not guaranteed, but you probably own a gun. If you are a member of the AARP, you have certain characteristics. If you subscribe to Cat Fancier Journal, you have certain characteristics. By the way, that's how the study was done. A company called R.L. Polk took all of the Volkswagen Beetle registrations from the country and cross-referenced it with people who either subscribed to various types of magazines and journals concerning cats or have purchased medication for cats, that sort of thing. And they were able to identify these people and market to them. If you subscribe to Soldier of Fortune magazine, you have a certain profile. If you subscribe to a journal for gay people, you are almost certainly gay. Today, anyone doing the minimal amount of research and spending a minimal amount of money can find out your likes, your dislikes, your sexual orientation, for sure your religion. I'm Jewish, and I have to tell you, every Jew in this country is on a mailing list. If you are Jewish, you get just a remarkable number of solicitations from everything from the UJA to the Jewish Defense League to what have you. I can't even log in. There's a guy, for those of you who can't see this, there's a guy holding together the phone jack with his thumb while I try to log on. I mean, this is pitiful. Well, if we get this working, let me tell you, today, Diogenes has which is what we named our database, Diogenes, the seeker after truth, has 4.1 billion records. Every single person in this room is in this database. This database is linked to every credit bureau. This database is linked to every corporate record, every property record, every voter registration record, which, if someone can please help me log on, I will demonstrate. It's my straight man over there. I see all sorts of tools coming over here. Okay. Hopefully in about 1 second I'm going to demonstrate this. Today, without leaving my office, I can find out where you live, where you work, who you live with, who you work with, more likely than not, your level of education, if not the school you attended, what you majored in. There are massive mailing lists for that sort of thing. And by the way, those of you that are starting college or in college now, do not reply to those credit card solicitations. Do not reply to those free student rate subscriptions, because we'll own you once you do. We will have everything on you, and we will track you forever. Today, sadly, something even I don't agree with, and I think all information should be gathered and be available. Thanks to the net and kid websites and that sort of thing, people are now being tracked from the age of as young as they can type, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10. By the time they actually turn 18 and start using their social security number, which they now have to apply for at birth, instead of when they applied for a job. By the time they turn 18, we'll know everything about them. For those of you that have logged on to Amazon after you've deleted your cookies and they still tell you, well, based on your last logins, we know that you're interested in Chinese cooking and murder mysteries, it's because they keep massive data files of you. They don't need to check a cookie. For those of you that log on to eBay and you're directed to an auction on Japanese flatware, it's because they've kept track of who you are based on your login. And if you've in any way, shape, or form connected your name to your login email address and password, it's there in the database by your name. It is child's play, as I'm sure everyone in this room knows better than me, to determine just from a name where you're living, what node you're logging on from, and very, very easily correlating that to the most likely address. If your name is Bob Jones and you're logging in from Ottumwa, Iowa, there's a limited number of possibilities who you are. I can find out if you are gay or straight, if you're Jewish, Muslim, or Catholic, if you are a deadbeat, or if you pay your debts, what your profession is, who you contribute to. And by the way, everyone who contributes to a political party and pays more than a fairly minuscule amount of money, your name, your address, your employer, and your position at that employer is now public record. I can go to fec.gov, download the file from your state, do a text search, and I got you. I just did a project with let's say an anti-fascist group, where I provided them with the name and address of everyone contributing to Lyndon LaRouche. For those of you who don't know who Lyndon LaRouche is, he he sued the B'nai B'rith for calling him a small-time Hitler. He lost. He is, in fact, a small-time Hitler. Now everyone who's contributed to his campaign will be receiving a letter asking why, and hopefully they won't contribute again. I know it's not exactly supportive of the general political process, but what can I tell you? Are we connected?
We are.
Okay. I promise you, it does not sound that bad on the videotape. I'm not quite sure why it sounds that bad here, but it's all digital, so it should have sounded good. But if you could see the kind of way we have this set up, you might understand that sometimes things don't get recorded quite properly. But I think you got the gist of what Steve Rambam was saying. A private investigator who spoke at H2K and went on for over an hour giving out all kinds of fascinating bits of information that the average person just does not know. The average person doesn't know how much information is kept on computers about them and what they can do to prevent this information from getting out. It's something that in the hacker world, we're very familiar with how to protect privacy. We're familiar with how important privacy is, how fragile it is. And ironically, in the mass media, hackers get blamed as the attackers of privacy. It's not that way at all. The people who are out there to get the information are the people in government, the people in mass marketing, the people who just want to make a sale one way or the other by collecting as much information on you as possible. Well, this is one way to learn how to prevent that from happening, how to protect yourself. We're offering that video along with 16 others. It's a phenomenal amount of videos.
That's a lot of video.
A lot of it. This will, if you have like a lengthy illness or something, you need to spend a lot of time indoors for like the next 6 months or something like that. This is the package for you. And if you don't, and if you just want to stay inside and watch something, or if you want to invite friends over, there's all kinds of possibilities here. 16 tapes, each one about 2 hours long. It's about 32 hours of video right there from the conference. So if you missed the conference, this is the package for you.
That's the invalid package?
We're open to all different types of people. Invalids, people with all kinds of, I don't know.
Reasons for sitting on a couch
exactly.
For 32 hours.
Yeah. if you have a videotape recorder, this is the thing to get. $125 pledge, 212-209-2950. You will get 17 videos, including the Steve Rambam talk. Also, other things included in there. We'll be hearing a couple of excerpts from the hacktivism panel, with basically computer hackers mixed with the world of activism, and it's called hacktivism. We'll learn something about that. We have the complete mock trial. If you recall, last year we were on trial for the DECSS program. Well, we conducted a little mock trial at the Hotel Pennsylvania during the H2K conference last July, and the results of that turned out a lot better than the results of the real trial. But it was also very educational and rather humorous. So you'll get that as well. You'll get the high school horror tales, find out all kinds of things that happen to kids in high schools these days as far as invasion of privacy and being accused of being a computer hacker and what that means to your freedom. We have a special on Napster, a panel on Napster, how back in its, I guess, earlier days than now, certainly.
Yeah.
And back before it was killed, as it was yesterday for the most part. All kinds of panels, but the important thing is to support the radio station. We have zero calls on the line, so I want to see a little better than that. 212-209-2950. If you are at all interested in privacy, individual rights, individual liberties, then you need to see these videos. You really do, and we have a whole lot of them. A whole lot of them. 17 in all, 2 hours each of the H2K conference, which took place last July here in New York City. Isaac, what are some of your memories of
H2K.
H2K, yeah. It all was a big blur to me because I was running around trying to make sure everything was, what's going on.
For me, it was a lot more relaxed. I wasn't winding up trying to do everything like Beyond Hope.
Uh-huh. We have one call, 212-209-2950. You won't get this package anywhere else. In fact, if you go to the online store that we have, the 2600, you'll see that these videos go for much more than what we're offering them for tonight. So and we're probably not going to have any more after we do this because we're not going to be ordering these. It costs a lot to make videos. So take advantage of the deal now or forever regret it.
Yep.
I'm not kidding.
They're not going to be around after this.
I don't like to threaten people, but if you don't take advantage of it tonight, you're probably never going to get this chance again. HGK Video, they got two calls on the line, 212-209-2950. Every single HGK video that was shot there at the HGK conference. We have four calls. Okay, this
I recall the keynote by Jello.
Oh, yeah, of course. I forgot. Jello Biafra's keynote is in there as well.
It's in there.
Yeah, yeah, it's included. And you'll hear Jello Biafra speaking about all kinds of issues of liberty and computer issues as well. He delves into the computer issues. Even though he doesn't have a computer himself, he was able to speak intelligently about that. 212-209-2950. We have five calls on the line. It's very good to see support out there. More importantly than you getting 17 videos in the mail, and you will get 17 videos in the mail.
Big box.
Well, it's a lot of boxes, actually.
I think it's
about four different boxes you get.
Okay.
And also, you will get them a lot faster than the people that that pledged last pledge drive. We should have all gotten them by now, because we have them. Last time we were making them. Now we have them. They're sitting in a crate. They're ready to go. So as soon as you fulfill your pledge, they're going out to you, just like that. 212-209-2950. Make our volunteers busy, because they're all down there to answer phones. We don't want them chatting with each other. No. We can do that later. We want them to chat with you and help support the station at the same time, because that's the important reason for you to be calling. Not so much to get the videos. It's nice to get videos. You know, we're happy to donate these to the radio station, but the most important thing is to keep this place going. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about all the problems that have been going on over the years. And, yeah, it's not just recent. It's not just something that's been going on over the last couple of months. BAI has a long and troubled history. Pacifica has a long and troubled history. It's always been the case, and it probably always will be the case. You know, and in a way, I hope it is the case that we are always in some kind of crisis mode, because when you're in crisis mode, you tend to be more alert. You tend to not let things just slip by. You tend to notice when something bad happens, and you tend to react to it. And that's the state we need our listeners in. That's the state we need our programmers in. And I think we're at our best when we're in that particular state. 212-209-2950.
Well, it's not a very comfortable state, but
no, it's not.
It is highly efficient.
It's not. It can be very stressful, and I really feel for people who are here more than once a week, like I am, who have to deal with this on an everyday basis. But running a radio station is no small task.
No,
commercial, whatever. Well, commercial, you know, I can go on about commercial stations, you know, till the cows come home, and how it's a waste of the electromagnetic spectrum, really, to just be on there hawking your wares and playing the same songs over and over again. Here at WBAI, we talk about important issues. And the issues that we just heard now, even though they sounded like crap on the radio, they'll sound much better when you hear them on video.
And you get to see the people talking.
And you can see people, too, which is also something we can't do on the air. But that kind of information is just not said on other radio stations. You know what's true. If you just go down the dial, it doesn't matter. Even if you go into, non-commercial NPR-type stations, they just play music. You know, they play music and they do their light talk shows and things like that. But BAI has always been hard-hitting. But when you're hard-hitting, there's a price for that. There's a few prices for that. You know, there's stress. There's all kinds of conflict that happens every now and then, but it's necessary. And the other cost, which is also necessary, is financial. Because you'll notice we're not breaking for commercials. We're not stopping to say that IBM has something to say to you, or that it's time for you to drink a Coke or something like that. We're not saying any of that. Oh, I said it, but I said it to make a point. I'm not getting paid to say that.
I'm not going to call you on that.
Yeah.
That's okay.
All right, I'll say it's time to drink a Pepsi, too, there. I couldn't say both. There's no way I could possibly get away with that.
But that's the kind of freedom that we're offered here by having a station that's supported by the listeners. You know, our hands are basically untied, and we can talk about the things that are of interest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the
Absolutely.
Only way we can do that is if we manage to support ourselves. So please call 212-209-2950.
We have six calls on the line right now, which means we've filled up the entire first bank. I'd like to see a call go into the second bank.
I would like to see that.
It's always nice to see those lights light up as well.
It's like a little Christmas tree.
We have four banks. I don't know if anyone's ever lit up all four, but who knows? We'll give it a shot tonight. Well, we don't have that many volunteers. I don't know what's going to happen in there. 212-209-2950. Okay, there we go. It's two more. And I hope three more. I hope people aren't just calling to make the phone ring, because that's, it's not something that is very nice. And please make sure that you fulfill your pledge, because it does matter. It all adds up. We started at zero. I know the Tally people haven't had a chance to actually add things up yet, but I see that's up to 450, but I know that hasn't taken into account all the ringing lines. So please keep those phone calls coming in, 212-209-2950. If there is any reason why you should call, if you're having doubts and all kinds of hesitation because of things that may have disturbed you in the past or in the present, just think of these words, these four words. This is the reason why you should pledge, because we're still here. There'll be plenty of time not to pledge if we're not still here, but while we are here, we need your support. That's the reason right there. Yeah, things won't be 100% the way you want them to be. There may be all kinds of problems, but there are people here who are working really, really hard to do the best they can under the situation. And with support, I think it'll work out. But without support, I know it won't work out. You see, that's the one thing I'm sure of. Without support, it will definitely not work. With support, well, it just might. We won't know, though, unless you call 212-209-2950. You know, there are people who give up easily, but, you know, they're probably not listening.
Yep.
What's the point? You know, if you've given up, why listen? If you give up, walk away. Someone else will come and take your place. Unfortunately, we want to have those people who think, though. We want to have those people who are committed to what BAI stands for. We don't want those people to walk away. So if you have your radio on, if you're listening, the other part of having the radio on and listening is contributing. 212-209-2950, because you're the sponsors. Not Coke, not IBM, not Pepsi, you. 212-209-2950. We actually got almost into the third bank.
That's impressive.
That's very impressive. All right. Well, my voice is getting tired. I know I play the other piece as well. We have two deals right now.
We have two deals.
Yeah, I'm going to announce the second deal. Might as well do it now, in case people are kind of, you know, flip-flopping from one to the other. They need to have some kind of a choice. In addition to all the videos, 17 videos, we have a second option, and this is for a pledge of $200.
Okay.
$200. Every single back issue of 2600 back to 1984.
Wow.
Oh, yes.
Those are these stapled and folded over ones?
Well, I don't know if they're folded over anymore. The original ones, when we sent them out in the little envelopes, had to be folded. Mm-hmm. We never stapled.
We
stapled, you know, the issues that are bound.
Right. Yeah.
But no, the original 1984 through 86, those were sheets of paper. You see? Sheets of paper. They just had little holes punched in them. That's all. And in 1987, we continued to be monthly, but we adopted the current format of digest size with, I think, 24 pages.
Right.
And that turned out to be extremely expensive and also very time-consuming. So in 1988, we decided to go quarterly and double the size. And we've been that way, increasing pages every few years ever since. So you can get every single issue we've ever published from 1984 to 2000.
And you could have followed along with that whole line of reasoning by going through your own archives and pick out those 1984, 1985, 1986, 2600s. It's really cool to go back into the history,
yeah,
see what was going on at the time, because it's not just pure technology. You've got a lot of social commentary on the events of the time. I mean, I go back to a 1989 issue I have, and mm-hmm. we're talking about what was going on then.
The Galactic Hacker Party, I remember that. The Galactic Hacker Party in Amsterdam, that was a turning point in 1989.
That was a big thing.
Every year has something, and if you really want to understand the hacker culture, and there really is a hacker culture, and it's fascinating, then reading the issues, I think, is the best way of doing that, because we just have covered so much over the years. It's really amazing. The look has changed, the attitude has changed, the technology certainly has changed. I mean, back, you know, in 1984, what was technology like? We all had 300 baud modems, and, you know, we were using CompuServe, I think. And
CompuServe was great.
And the source. Was AOL even around in 1984?
Not to my knowledge.
When did AOL start?
It was probably a little later, 86, 87.
Those are the good old days. No AOL. Imagine that. Most people weren't on the net. Most people had UUCP connections, if they had any connection at all to the net.
What was the net at that point?
Yeah, there was no real net. And
it was NSF net, and that was...
addresses were separated with exclamation points known as bangs.
Yes.
That was kind of cool. But it made it very consumer unfriendly, so nobody in their right mind who wasn't already a techie would want to have that kind of address. It just went on for two lines. You know, some people still have addresses like that. They figured out ways of routing things.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. You can be part of all that. You can see some of the things of the past, the predictions, things that never came true, the forgotten people of the past, all the people who have been imprisoned over the years. And, you know, even if you're not into technology at all, the social aspects of this are something which are simply staggering. To see how society has changed since 1984, to see how freedom has been compromised time and time again. I mean, there are things going on now that if we just suddenly adopted them back in 1984, it never would have been accepted.
Oh, there would have been people in the streets.
I remember when people were upset about caller ID. They said, caller ID, that's going to be a big invasion of our privacy. In fact, we talked about it on this radio show.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's just accepted. It's an everyday part of life. Nobody thinks twice about it.
Well, now people are remiss from picking up the phone if they don't have the caller ID come across. They're like,
that's right.
Restricted number, what's that?
Anonymous person call.
Right.
212-209-2950. Call to get every single back issue of 2600 Magazine. Going back to 1984, that's a lot of issues. I can't possibly do the multiplication. I, 12 issues from 1984 to 1987, and then 4 issues a year from 1988 until the present. And believe me, that's a lot of reading.
Many, yes.
If you get that and you get the videos, that's it for the year for you. I mean, there's nothing else you'll have time for.
Say goodbye to your friends and family. You're just going to disappear into your couch for...
Or say hello to your friends and family and invite them in. Share issues.
I like that, too.
And say, Uncle Edgar, Aunt Nellie, did you see this? This is amazing. Look at what they were doing with technology back in 1992.
You sit them down on that couch. You make them watch those H2K videos. They'll enjoy it. I guarantee it.
212-209-2950. So we have two options here. We have the full set of H2K videos, 17 videos, 34 hours, I guess. It's about that. Some are a little shorter, some are a little longer. And that's for a pledge of $125. And for a pledge of $200... every single back issue of 2600 Magazine. Now, I know there's about 200 people online right now listening to us. Thanks to our online people, our real audio and MP3 cutters and streamers, we're able to get out to the entire world more so than just about any other show out there. And because of their hard efforts, people all around the world have been turned on to this program and to this radio station by extension. We'd like to hear from those people as well. And again, I should point out that any amount is welcome.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not just...
You're not just locked into those two specific, price structures. If you got $30, if you got $50, if you got $20, if you got $2,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we can use it. If you send it to us, we will definitely put it to use to bring you some of this kind of programming.
212-209-2950 is our phone number. And again, any amount is welcome because it is going to a good cause, going to the radio station. And that keeps us going. So it's all a step-by-step process. Imagine if every single one of those 200 people listening now on the Internet called and pledged simply $25. You got a calculator there? What would that come out to?
Ooh, hang on. I got a very big
calculator. Show you the power of numbers here, you know. Because if you're online, you have a computer, you have a phone line, you obviously have, the means to do that.
Why couldn't I do that 5, in my 000. Head? It's $5,000.
$5,000. Just like that, $5,000. 212-209-2950. For those of you in other parts of the world, country code 1. So if you're in Europe, I think you dial 00, then 1, and then 212-209-2950. Okay, now let's get on to the second part of the H2K conference that we're highlighting here tonight. This is... A discussion that took place about hacktivism, cracking the hacker myth. And it featured three people, two from the Cult of the Dead Cow, Reed Fleming and Oxblood, and our own shapeshifter, the guy who does layout for us, and the guy who was also imprisoned by the Philadelphia police for the Republican National Convention back in August. This was before that happened, so obviously you have a bit of historical perspective now. 212-209-2950. Keep those calls coming in while we listen to a portion of this videotape, which is included in the H2K package. Again, the two packages, $125 for every single H2K video, $200 for every single 2600 back issue. And I guess you could pledge $325 and get everything if you really are.
I like that.
Yeah. Okay, then go ahead and do it. Walk right down the hall and...
All right, well...
Yeah.
We'll get this started first.
While this is... Let me just make sure I press the right buttons here. I'm pressing number one. Okay. All right, again, it's probably not going to sound great. The video is much, much better, but we'll just have to bear with it. Here goes.
I've got a suggestion, because this seems to be a little bit more a workshop than a lecture, and I think that's okay. So, in the beginning, when defining hacktivism, it might be a good idea to say at least what hacktivism is not, because I think the hacking community has to be very carefully. We live in the year 2000. If someone robs out a bank, he doesn't take a machine gun, he takes a computer. And if a political group having lots of bull Ukraine protesting against anything, there might be forms where we can say that's hacktivism, but if it comes to denial on service of infrastructures, or we had that story with a legion of underground, I remember maybe you can say some words to that. So I don't want to be involved in terrorism, and I think it's very important for hackers to say we're driven by curiosity and not by denial of service, which is vandalism, or by, you know, financial interest in robbing banks or whatever. So I think it might be a good idea to make a list what is hacktivism, at least from the motivation, and what's it not, so to get also in the media a little bit more sharpened picture on this.
Sure. Although I don't know if you were here for the last panel, the prospects of educating the media are kind of poor, I guess. But
yes, I was, and that's the reason why I'm standing up, because I think it's a sad picture if there's a hacker conference and then we talk about what is hacking, and someone says, oh, it might be this, it might be this. So I mean, read the hacker ethics; it's written down. Hackers want information to be free, so it has to do with learning by doing. It has to do with by curiosity. And it has not to do, maybe not even to do with computers, for me. Okay. I mean, computers is just a tool, and tools might change, but the motivation should not change. Because otherwise, it might be like getting a hammer in your hand, and then the whole world looks like nails, and that's a dangerous situation.
Right. Those are good comments and questions. I'm a little afraid to step forward and say what is hacktivism and what it is not, because I think intelligent people can have serious disagreements over this. Myself, and I think for the rest of the CDC, we agree that we should not be denying access to the internet or to particular websites just because you disagree with the content on it, whether that's a corporate site or, you know, a political site that you happen to disagree with greatly. I think we believe that more speech is better speech, that, you know, if you're serious about the marketplace of ideas that the internet's supposed to be, that you're not going to go try to damage infrastructure on a country level, on a website level, on a, you know, whatever, backbone level.
I think one of the issues that will be evolving over time, and we'll have to figure out how to deal with it, is part of the whole activist perspective is the issue of civil disobedience. It's something we saw through the civil rights movement. It's probably the easiest example in the United States, where certain groups broke the law of the land because, in their view, it was immoral. So there's always been sort of this idea of occasionally breaking the law to further social justice. Now, in certain instances, it's extremely clear. You know, apartheid, issues of civil rights issues in the United States and other things. And over time, these things have been addressed. But a lot of people were arrested, and they sought to be arrested. And this is one of the things that I'm almost worried about with hacktivism, that people make excuses to do something rather extreme, and who's going to decide, well, is this a good idea or is it not? Is this moral or not? I mean, at the end of the day, the public is going to decide whether they agree with something or not. But this is going to be something that's definitely going to be coming up. And I don't know, like, if you're like me, occasionally you read Wired News and you find out that somebody has defaced a certain website and they're saying that it's hacktivism. I'm often very confused. I can't tell often the difference between somebody defacing a web page and somebody saying they're doing it for political reasons. So I think it's become somewhat convenient to saying, you know, one is doing this for hacktivist reasons, and it's there are quite a few gray areas, as there are all throughout hacking in general.
I don't know. one small comment and a new question. Real brief. Tweetyfish, I think, actually laid out a pretty good ground rule for whether or not it's hacktivism. That is, did you pick your cause before you picked the site? I think that's a pretty logical thing. That's all I wanted to add.
First of all, I want to say, Mr. Biafra, I remember getting wounded at your shows 15, 16 years ago and enjoying it.
I'm a little younger than Mr. Joe Biafra.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had to put the hat louder. Okay, well, good thing I didn't say that very loud. My question is this. I had an experience. I read a Bruce Sterling book recently called Distraction. And in Distraction, and I believe this was written before the WTO demonstrations, there were some very interesting things that he talked about in terms of people organizing and in very interesting ways and doing things to provoke change using old-school technology, new-school technology, using identity-changing things, using economic systems that were not part of the mainstream economic system. I read that. I got very interested in hacktivism, I suppose, because it was a science fiction book. And I went through a bunch of East Village bookstores and activist bookstores in New York, and I found nothing except a lot of leftist rhetoric that was mostly anti-technological. And my question is, I think it's important for the activist community, and I'm not, whether it's leftist or some other term applies better, I don't care. I think it's important for people that are pro-technology and see their uses, the positive uses of technology, to communicate with theorists who I think are very used to seeing technology as a negative thing. And I'm wondering, is there a way, how can we get together and communicate with, quote-unquote, the other side? I have been in parts of both. I've been an activist, and I'm also kind of pro-technology for certain reasons. And what can be done to unite these two people? I think if leftists or activists can see the uses of technology in a certain light, there will be a lot less rhetoric against it, and there will be a lot more movement in certain directions that may be hacktivist-oriented. But I have no idea how these type of negotiations would take place.
Well, I can sort of answer that. I think technology is bad in some aspects, and it's good in others. It's bad when an oil company has the technology and they're drilling on somebody's native land. I think that's a bad application of technology, or when it's used for things like nuclear weapons. I mean, make any sense at all. I mean, you're going to blow up half the world so you can show out how big off, like, how big your guns are, or how big, like, your technology is, or how tough you are. I think some applications of technology are just completely useless and bad, but then there's other things, that, like, in demonstrations, in most of the WTO demonstrations and the A16 demonstrations in D.C., we had a whole communications network set up where we could tell what was going on across the entire city, like what the police were doing, what the delegates were doing, and we were able to coordinate using that technology. So I think communications technology can be good when it's in the hands of activists and social justice activists. And also, there's the issue of the independent media. The independent media was maybe by using, they had a high-speed connection to the Internet, and that helped the social justice activists in that we got our story unedited to massive amounts of people. There was we had satellite uplinks, and people in cable access TV stations around the country were able to download that. So I think if we sort of democratize the use of technology, then we can, like, it's totally useful. But as far as Microsoft and, you know, you name it, what corporation, I don't think they should have the control of technology. So.
Not to disagree, you raise a lot of points that I totally agree with. I'm really setting this up wrong. I think if you're my kind of activist, your particular political opinions don't really enter into it. I don't particularly care if you happen to be very liberal on most political issues or conservative. It's really not my thing, but the thing I'm most interested in is, what do you think about global internet liberties? You know, what do you think about citizens of the world being able to access the internet, being able to browse the web and send mail to whoever they want without interference from the government or tracking? You know, they need to be able to have free speech, privacy, access, and encryption. And if you're for those things, I think you are, by default, a hacktivist, or you're a hacktivist sympathizer.
The only thing that one thing he said that sort of like makes a question to me is a lot. Most people don't have access to the internet.
Right.
Majority of the people on this planet don't have access to the internet, and that's a big gap. And right now, the way it is, most people don't have enough resources to get a computer, and that's sort of a mark of the economic system we're currently in. Is capitalism sort of makes sure that some people get a whole lot of money, and then most of the rest of the world has to support those few people and their habits.
Well, I agree entirely, although I don't know if you've noticed, it was a very small blurb in the San Jose Mercury News last month, but I think it was three paragraphs stating that the United Nations had released a report predicting that by the end of 2004, every single human being on the planet will be within half a day's walk of an internet terminal. Whether or not they will have money to pay for it is a different story. And whether or not their government will allow them to access the news sites they want to actually read or publish information, for that matter, that's a different story. But the raw hardware will be there in a very short order, I think.
So I think it's interesting that there's sort of not two sides of this issue, but two different perspectives. You from the direct action side and us from the hacking community. I think it's very valuable that as many people as possible get a hold of computers and do have access. I think that's one particular challenge, and it's very noble work to really initiate and get that going. My particular take on this is I want to make sure that when those people do get onto the internet, that it's still essentially free. The things that I'm looking at really have to do specifically with internet freedoms, and I have all kinds of respect and compassion for what's going down on the earth, but what I can actually do is happening a little closer to technology, and I think that that in itself, I mean, that kind of work has been going on for a long time of people trying to keep the internet free and scientifically pure and open to as many people as possible and as uncontrolled as possible and as close to its original intent as possible.
Hola. Sorry. My name is Ricardo Dominguez. I'm from the Electronic Disturbance Theater and also a former member of the Critical Art Ensemble. Two books that might be useful: The Electronic Disturbance and Electronic Civil Disobedience and Other Unpopular Ideas, published by Autonomy Media. Also, The Electronic Disturbance Theater initiated a series of weak denial of service systems or powerful symbolic presence or virtual sit-ins on President Zedillo's website all through 1998 in response to the Octal massacre against the Zapatista communities. But I've had a brief dialogue with both CDC and some other communities, not directly, but indirectly. And the critique of direct action versus free speech, I think, is very important. Both of them, I think, as you said, are valid issues. But again, as Tweedy, I think, has pointed out, if one has been grounded in long-term activism, that is, I was working with the Zapatistas since the beginning. I was already thinking about electronic civil disobedience since the 80s in terms of its relationship to ACT UP and AIDS activism and what we could do in terms of force multiplying the voice of a community. And I agree that if we were to do radical denial of service against any part of the internet in a long-term way, it would be something that would go against, I think, a technologically optimistic community that would should look to network as much of the world as possible. But I also believe that there are times and spaces where a direct action is necessary. And how that direct action is played out, I think, is up to specific cells, and I think those cells should be aware of the dynamics that will take place. When the Electronic Disturbance Theater did its gestures of the Zapatista floodnet, we knew that an element of bandwidth would be taken up, that it wasn't the most technologically adept use of the technology, but we did see it as a way to promote in the mass media the issue of Zapatismo and what was going on in Chiapas, and that was our main focus. And the way we measured the strength of an action was if in the media, in the first paragraph, they mentioned the Zapatistas, then that was a victory for us. And I would say about 75% of the time it was indeed mentioned in the first paragraph. When we lost something was when they mentioned cyber terrorism or cyber crime, which is what they tried to put electronic civil disobedience into. But one of the agendas that we have been trying to put forth is nonviolent direct action. How does that happen online, and how can it also help people on the streets? And one way that it can help in implementing more nonviolent direct action is to make sure that the information war ecologies, be they right or left, such as Wynne Schwartzhoff or Dorothy Dennings, is that they try to understand the difference between electronic civil disobedience, cyber terrorism, and cyber crime. And I think to a certain extent we, the hacktivist communities, has been rather victorious. Just recently on May 23rd, Dorothy Denning presented to the U.S. Arms Appropriation Committee on Cyber Terrorism her dialogue on cyber terrorism. And she specifically mentions the electronic hippies, the electronic disturbance theater, I believe Cult of the Dead Cow, and a few others. And she specifically states that this is not cyber terrorism, it is not cyber crime. And I think to a certain extent that does allow and give us a certain amount of leverage, especially when we're dealing with the media, which is ultimately the kind of process, whether we want it or not, the way it spreads itself out. Anyway, it was more of a statement than a question, but I do also wanted to thank all of you for the fine work that you have done and continue to do. Thank you.
Thank you.